Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
This week, the farmer who's half in and half out. No, not Brexit, but of DEFRA's new higher risk zones for avian flu.
They have to be called barm eggs. Now, obviously, there is a financial penalty to us if we sell them for barm instead of free range. Free range eggs are a premium product, and so it would affect our farm financially.
And amid uncertain times, we meet the grain dryer specialists who've just expanded.
What we're finding is that long-term investments are still being made, and that's still very important because looking over farming over a short term is not always the best point of view.
Sunday, February 12th, 2017. This is the Farming Programme with Sean Dunderdale.
Good morning. As you may have heard in the week, the ongoing problem with avian flu is bringing real concern over the future of free-range poultry producers, with many facing serious threats to their business. You'll remember since last December, all bird owners have been ordered to keep them indoors. That restriction could soon be lifted, though it would still be enforcing what's now known as higher risk zones, outlined this week by DEFRA. It means producers in those areas will soon no longer, by law, be able to sell free-range eggs or meat. Instead, they'll be known as barn eggs. Alison Pratt is from the National Farmers Union.
It looks as if it's areas where there are lots of wild birds, particularly waterfowl and gulls. So that's the coast, and particularly also looking at it, areas where there is inland water, so big lakes and areas of water that would attract gulls and waterfowl. This is the danger that the disease is still circulating in the wild bird population. There's still a high risk that it could get to domestic birds, and we've got to stop them getting together.
Initially, the worry was about migrating birds, wasn't it? Kind of landing on the east coast from mainland Europe. And the feeling now, then, by the sounds of it, is, as you say, it is in those birds, those gulls or whatever it might be, those wild birds that are near waterways, really.
Yes, that's the danger. I think the risk is still very much there, and that I think is what producers of all sizes, again saying whether you've got two birds or 20,000, you must think whether your birds should be protected. And that applies whether you're going to be in one of these new high-risk areas or the low-risk area. The risk could still be there in what DEFRA is terming the low-risk area.
And in the high-risk areas, then, it will be all birds, won't it? You know, if you've got two chickens that you keep at home or you are a large poultry farmer, they must be kept indoors.
Unless you can net the range.
Okay.
And for a commercial producer, that's going to be nigh on impossible because the size of a commercial free-range house would mean that the numbers of birds would need hectares of ranging land, and you can't net hectares of ranging land. The free-range rules still apply, the welfare rules still apply. You still have to allow them the full access to their whole range, and to net that area would just be impossible.
Now, you touched there on the free-range poultry producers. Mm. I mean, this could have a devastating effect for them, couldn't it?
Yes, for those who are in the high-risk area, the loss of the free-range status could mean a huge effect on their business. NFU all the time is talking to our friends in the retail chain, talking to all the big suppliers, all the people who buy eggs all the way up the chain and process them. We're talking to them all the time to try and get a consensus about what could happen if we're not allowed to have free-range status back. And that looks as if it could now be the case for a significant number of producers in the country.
And are you getting any messages of support back? Is there any indication how it might go?
I think retailers understand the situation. After all, they want to, you know, maintain their supplies of eggs. What, of course, we can't do is to sell them as free range after the 28th of February if they come from housed birds. That's European law. Again, NFU's been talking in Europe to the European Commission and to our fellow farming organisations all over Europe to try and come to some sort of a decision about this. But the plain truth is that avian influenza is there. It's a virulent bug, H5N8. If it gets into your poultry, it will kill them. And we must keep it out of the domestic flock and out of our commercial flocks if we possibly can.
Alison Pratt of the NFU. Charles Lowe is a free-range producer, though looking at the map, Charles, you're half in, half out of one of the proposed high-risk zones, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. So in principle, the government have agreed by the end of February we can let our free-range birds out unless you are specified in a high-risk zone. We, unfortunately, are half in and half out of a high-risk zone. So the detail essentially means that we can call our birds free-range again and they can be let out onto the range.
That must be a welcome relief, obviously, over the last few weeks, having to keep the birds indoors. Free range is all important to a business like yours, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what the government have said is that the risk is still high. Avian flu is still present in the environment. Everybody must maintain strict biosecurity, limit vehicles on and off the farm, limit movement around the chickens themselves. But some areas are higher risk than others. And so the government has suggested various measures in those zones, such as keeping the birds in for a further length of time to protect them.
Have that zone been slightly more in, if you like, if your farm had been within that zone fully, what kind of effect would that have had to a farm like yours?
Housing the birds for more than 12 weeks. So they've been inside since the 6th of December. We were forced to keep them in. The 12-week expires on the end of February. And so after that length of time, they have to be called barm eggs. Now, obviously, there is a financial penalty to us if we sell them for barm instead of free range. Free range eggs are a premium product. And so it would affect our farm financially.
So thankfully, not by the looks of things anyway, and we hope nothing changes. But I guess, has there been an impact over the last 12 weeks or so, you know, since they have been indoors? You've obviously still been able to sell the eggs, but for the chickens themselves, you know, they naturally want to be outdoors, don't they?
Chickens do naturally want to be outside. They're free-range birds and they love to be outside. We as farmers want the chickens outside because it's what we're used to seeing and it's what the chickens are used to doing. But they've coped remarkably well, actually. We inside the sheds, we have an area where we like them to scratch and dust bathe. So we've been maintaining those areas with a lot of wood chip and straw and trying to promote that natural behaviour. They seem fine being inside. We would love them to be outside as soon as we can, but they cope well being inside.
Free-range poultry producer Charles Lowe, half in, half out, shake it all about, do the hokey-cokey. It's an issue I know we will return to, especially as we get nearer to the end of the month. Now, time for our weekly update from our friends at Open Field and a welcome return of Chris Spratt.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Chris. Last time you were on the programme, it was Boxing Day. You were singing
on
the
pantomime.
Yeah. And I think you've been in hiding since.
I have. If anybody out there has had cellulitis, then I really do feel for you because that's what's taken hold of me for the past month. But
you're back
getting
now.
Back there now, fighting fit, Sean.
Well, it's good to see you.
Thank
back.
You very much, yeah.
So what's happening then?
Well, interesting, really. There was a USDA report came out on Thursday night. I think most of the announcements there were probably anticipated by the trade, really. There was a cut of 4.7 million tonnes from the January estimate of wheat. Of stocks, and I think that mainly came from an idea that they'd cut Indian stocks by 3 million tonnes. I think the trade probably anticipated that a while ago. And also in Kazakhstan, there was reductions there. So, you know, just a little bit of topping and tailing in various places, really. Domestically, I think, well, little fresh news, really. The market appears to be tight on the old crop, but we do need to keep a watchful eye on that currency and on any potential imports or alternative commodities displacing UK feed wheat as we get to the final quarter of the season, anyway. Internationally, as with any big crop, logistics are always there to try and cause an issue. And in Australia, the first grumbles are being talked about the lack of logistical shipping slots. And basically, you get into a situation where you can buy the grain out there, got a big crop of most commodities, but it's no use if you can't finally find a place to ship it from to put it on a ship. In Australia, I think over the next few weeks, they're going to have to decide really what's most important, milling wheat to India before they close the doors in March and they get their new crop coming through, oilseed rape into the EU, which we know is a good price at the moment, malting barley to China, wheat to Indonesia, or feed barley to Saudi. Contract prices will dictate that, and the shorts, you know, who thought that Australia may well give cargoes away fairly cheaply this season, might have to be looking elsewhere. Domestically in the UK, UK bread making values still remain under pressure, with little if any premium dependent on area. Feed barley, well, the recent Saudi tender there was fixed for 1.5 million tonnes for execution between March and May. If we take into account the freight and the extra shipping costs, and related that back to an ex-farm UK price, that would be around about 117 to 118 ex-farm. I think there'll be plenty of competition to supply into that market from Argentina, Canada, EU, Black Sea, Australia. It's a total of 30, you know, big ships over a few months period. But spread around internationally, I don't think it's going to make too much of an impact. But it might put a floor in the market for any country that you know, can do the spec and has got the tonnage. UK barley domestically is trading about £4 to £6 above that level at the moment. We're now starting to see domestic market take support from middle market buyers on the malting barley, and you know, we've still got a volatile sterling. So what we're seeing at the moment is domestic values on the old crop actually nudge ahead of the export market. We could, of course, see some correction if shorts get filled in, as consumers, I think, really will want to sit back if they get half a chance and try and take a bit of sting out of the market. If we take a look at the crop malting barley that's about to go in the ground, well, consumers are sticking with their views for the time being that a larger crop will mean lower prices, and we'll have to see about that. Long way to go yet. Further afield, if we look at the malting barley sort of scenario on a bigger basis, the USD export figures for Canada and Australia have been released, and they're reflecting the record export numbers for both countries. The Canadian crop was around about a 7% increase on the prior year, even on a lower harvested area. On the back of that, Canada's exports are forecast to rise 40% over last year. Australia is expected to export a record 7.5 million tonnes of barley. 2 million tonnes of that will be malting out of a total crop of 11 million tonnes, the main home being into China. I think, you know, from a grower's point of view, certainly if I was in that seat making decisions, I'd be certainly looking at these malting barley premiums on the further forward, and maybe not an opportunity I'd be missing, really, both for any barleys that are left for 16 crop, for 17 crop, and in actual fact for 18 crop as well. Oilseed rape values slightly off the highs, buyers reducing their bids or trying to. The seller's willingness to offer any volumes capped any significant fall. French Farm Ministry this week's warned that their crop is in poor condition and that might be replaced with alternative crops in the spring. So, you know, we're still looking as though we might see a bit of downward revision there. They're already forecast to be 5% term below the average due to dry weather during the autumn planting. So in the UK, well, and in Europe, fundamentally, rapeseed supplies are tight and look like they're going to remain that way for the rest of the season. The bean market, well, that continues to be firm, £160 to £162 ex, achievable in most areas for Feb March, and a couple of pound more for May. That firmness is being driven really by short covering in the spot position and lack of sellers. A lot of growers sat out there with human consumption beans are looking for a premium, but in actual fact, at this moment in time, the human consumption market is getting towards the end of the season as far as that's concerned. There's better quality available from Australia once it can get shipped, and old crop sales into North Africa at the minute are being shipped from the Baltic states. If we were able to make export sales to Egypt, I think given the firm feed price at the moment, we'd probably only be looking at £2 to £3 premium. And as the wheat tip by, it looks like less and less likely that we'll see any significant volume demand. And that really means the feed heap will get bigger. But nevertheless, it's not all bad news. That feed price is almost as good as most people have been selling human consumptions for the rest of the season. And if you just have a quick look at the supply and demand, we still could end up with maybe 100,000 tonnes of beans chickens floating around in the system looking for a market. Just a quick look at prices. Feed wheat for March, 145 to 148, with May, 147 to 150 ex-farm. Harvest feed wheat, 127 to 130, with November 17, 131 to 134. As I mentioned, old crop premiums for Group 1 milling wheat's now in low single digits, with new crop quoted £12 to £15 over feed. Feed barley for March, 121 to 124, plus £2 for May, with harvest 106.50 to 108.50, and November 112 to 115. As I mentioned before, good premiums for malting barley, and you know, if you can rest assured you can grow the quality, certainly worth looking at. All seed rate for March, trading in the region of 3.52 towards the end of the week, with May at 3.54. And harvest at 3.15 to 3.20, and November 17, 3.25 to 3.30. And I think just looking at all the UK crop pricing structures the remainder of the season, the old crop is at a premium to new crop, and we haven't seen that for the last year or two, so consumers will be watching the old crop prices and the new crop supply and availability situation, not wishing to take on too much expensive old crop on today's market. So really, the supply side needs to be a little bit cautious not to let that old crop premium slip away into the new crop values.
Thank you, Chris. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Sean.
Chris Spratt from Open Fields. In a moment, we're staying with grain, really. We'll meet the grain drying and storage specialists who've just expanded into new premises. Let's get our weekly update from the other Sean, Sean Sparling, shall we, of Sparling Agronomy Services, out and about once again.
Yes, good morning, Sean. I thought I'd start this week, just out of the blue, talking about the weather. Thought we'd have a change. I sit here on top of the wolds recording this, and I'm in the jaws of a blizzard. The land looks like the top of that cake at the beginning of the Great British Bake Off, with a very light dusting of icing sugar on it. And I've already seen three cars in the ditch. So be careful out there. It is treacherous. I would call this, it's not snow and it's not drizzle. It's more like snizzle. So just be careful. And I really don't know how they cope in countries like Switzerland when they get more than a millimetre of snow at any one time. But it does sort of help a little bit, because it's a bit of a nothing time of the year for spraying, February, and you get these weather conditions. If it's Atlantis that you've got to put on winter wheat, then you just need to make sure that you're putting it on A, to a dry leaf, and B, that in cold conditions like this, and bear in mind your soil temperatures are down below 3 degrees, so you're not going to get a lot of active growth and movement, despite the fact they do look like they're green up on these sunny days. It's more the chlorophyll fluorescing than it is active growth because of that soil temperature inhibiting growth. So you need to make sure you get 4 hours to dry the chemical onto the leaf, because if you've got no growth, the longer it gets to stick onto the leaf, the more chance it has to get in when the plant starts to grow. If you've got a wet leaf, or it comes dewy or snowy or snizzly or rainy, within that 4 hours it'll wash the Atlantis off the leaf, and then by the time the black grass starts to grow, there's nothing there to kill it. So timing is crucial. What I've always found is that if you've got Atlantis to apply in the spring, or Pacifica for that matter, if you wait until the soil temperature has been above 5 degrees for at least 5 days, and then in that following 7-day period after that 5 days, you get the Atlantis on, you probably stand the best chance of doing a good job. If you go on in these conditions and it stays inclement and we get more snizzle or more rain, potentially it's going to wash it off and it's not going to do the job. It's expensive stuff, so you want to get the most out of it. And of course, all the other things still apply. 12K maximum forward speed, fine medium spray quality, keep your water volumes right, make sure you're using the right boom height, the right nozzles, everything needs to be with you, and you get that period of dry weather and you should be okay. If the Atlantis is still capable of killing that black grass, it will do a job. But the more things you have that are right, the more chance you have of doing a good job. Oilseed rape, remember that your threshold for light leaf spot applications is 1 plant in 7. Many of the varieties now have reasonable resistance, but they're only 6s and 7s, and if it's a bad year for light leaf spot, it needs dealing with. So if you're finding it on more than 1 plant in 7, you need to deal with it. And pick a fungicide which is capable of giving you a bit of foamer control and alternaria control as well. Don't just go for a light leaf spot material. And remember, you only have protection against light leaf spot. I keep saying this, but it's quite important, because if you found it today and you went out and sprayed today and it stayed cold, the light leaf spot isn't going to move for the next 3 or 4 weeks. Therefore, what's the point putting the fungicide on? That's what you've got to think about. Every penny needs to be accounted for, and every penny you spend needs to bring you two back, or else it's not worth doing. I'm just biding my time. I'm not finding light leaf spot levels at that rate, so I'm just holding back at the moment and watching things. And also start to think about grass weed control, supplementary grass weed control in your oilseed rape. If your propizamide's been on and you're not happy with the result, you can still use Carbetamex until the end of February. But remember that I don't believe there's any backing from all parties on that sequence. So if you have a problem, speak to your advisor, make sure they understand that and make sure everything's safe for you and safe for the crop. And then moving, thinking on really to spring cropping, don't just dismiss peas and beans because the gross margins aren't very good. Think about the benefit that peas and beans bring to the rotation, not just the greening payment, but also a little bit of extra yield in perhaps next year's wheat crop. If you're following them with wheat, that might be a good thing if the price of wheat starts to rise. And the benefit you get to the soil from the nutrient and the organic matter and the nitrogen release, etc., etc. So there's a lot of things being talked about in offices. NMAXs should now all have been done. It's something you have to have in place. Just sit back and fine-tune, do some costings, work through the costs of mixes, the costs of fungicides, and try and build a strategy now while times are slow, because I can assure you that once spring kicks in, it's going to start and it won't stop.
Spring will be here before we know it indeed. Thank you, Sean Sparling of Sparling Agronomy Services. MacArthur Agriculture is holding its open day this week. Well, open 2 days, actually, Wednesday and Thursday, a chance to celebrate its recent expansion into bigger premises. John MacArthur is managing director there.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time for us. We've recently moved to a larger new premises, and that's enabled us to broaden our offering on the grain storage and processing equipment that we supply.
What about the history of MacArthur? Tell us a bit about it.
So we originally grew from a farm diversification in the 1990s. It was led by my father, and now myself and my brother Scott have followed him into the company and really taken it on from there.
And you say obviously expanding with the new premises at Flixborough.
Yeah, it's given us a lot more covered space, so we can do a lot more of assembly work, and we're also able to offer the continuous flow dryers and also the on-floor grain drying systems as well. And so really it's enabled us to take a big step forward.
And how is business at the moment? Uncertain times, as we keep saying in farming. Business okay though?
Business is very good. It's good to be broader with a wider product line. What we're finding is that long-term investments are still being made, and that's still very important, because looking over farming over a short term is not always the best point of view.
Mm-hmm. No, I know what you mean, though. Yeah, it is better to look at the long term, isn't it? You know?
Absolutely. And investment in grain storage equipment is very much a long-term investment. The minimum period that any equipment will be going out for would be 15, 20, 25 years. And you're really looking over those time horizons. Business is good.
Just talk us through some of the products you've got then, for those that don't know about you.
So the mainstay of the business and what it originally started from was with the Mecmar mobile grain dryer. Those machines have really changed a lot, from being a 12-ton tractor-driven machine that rattled in the corner of the yard to now the average machine size would be 24 tons. It would be electric-driven and fully automated. So really the way that that machine is used has changed substantially in the last 10 years.
So yeah, you said how things have developed and moved on. As you say, with some of these products, you're looking at 25 years hence. It's hard to believe where we'll be in 25 years' time technology-wise, isn't it? It's amazing, really.
Absolutely. What I would say is on your grains drying and storage, you look back 25 years and you look at the machines that we have today, and while they've changed, reliability's improved, durability's improved, the basic principles of grain drying and storage are established. And so there's very little change in that. So you're able to make that kind of long-term investment with some confidence that it's not attached to a fashion or a fad. It's very much down to the basic principles.
We talk about farm diversification a lot on the programme. A lot of farms had to go through that, but this proves it does work, doesn't it? This is a successful diversification, which is great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And going into farming was never really an option for myself and my brother directly. But this is a great way to give us a foothold in the industry. And actually, in some ways, it's even more enjoyable because rather than working in one place, we're working for hundreds and hundreds of farms across the UK. We see a great range of farms and a great diversity of people that we work with. And that's really satisfying.
John MacArthur of MacArthur Agriculture. Those open days at Flixborough happening on Wednesday and Thursday.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
Yes, turning to the weather then, and wintry showers, possibility of snow for a time, should dry out later, highs of 3 Celsius. That wind from the east-northeast, 20, gusting at 30, maybe even 35 miles an hour in places. Overnight tonight, warming up a little bit, 3 Celsius the low, still the possibility of a shower, but it should be mostly dry. The wind from the east, 15, gusting at 30. And tomorrow, a mostly sunny day, highs of 5 Celsius, that wind continuing to blow from the east, 20 to 30 miles an hour. Overnight Monday into Tuesday, clear skies, a frost is likely, temperatures generally of around 1 Celsius, should be dry, the wind continuing from the east at 10, gusting at 30 miles an hour. And then Tuesday itself, Valentine's Day, looks like a sunny day, mostly, bit of cloud, 6 Celsius the high, the wind from the east-southeast between 12 and 20 miles an hour. For the middle of the week, warming up a little bit, possibility of a shower or two for Wednesday, but temperatures peaking at around 8 Celsius, the wind more from the south, hence the temperatures rising 5 to 10 miles an hour. And then for the latter end of the week, we could see temperatures going back up to maybe 9 or 10 Celsius. There is the possibility of a shower, but some sunny spells as well. Overnight lows generally 4 to 6 Celsius, and that wind continuing from the south-southwest at 10 to 20 miles an hour. That's the forecast then. If you are going to the MacArthur Open Day, I hope it goes well. Mention you heard it on the Farming Programme. Spread the word. Go on. Next week, the penultimate update on this year's beet campaign. Plus, of course, whatever else is happening in the world of agriculture, as ever. Until then, have a good week's farming.